Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:35 p.m. on Thursday, the 30th of January, 2025. Present today are Representative Bynum, Representative Johnson, Representative Hannon, Representative Stapp, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Galvin, Representative Jimmy, and the co-chairs, Representative Foster, Representative Schrage, and myself, co-chair Josephson. Also present today are our House Finance Staff Committee Assistant Helen Phillips, Paige Reed Gardinier, Secretary Bree Wiley, Secretary Leah Frazier. Before we start, please mute your cell phones. We thank you in advance for that. In today's meeting, we will hear the Legislative Finance Division present its 2026 fiscal overview. With us today is Legislative Fiscal Analyst slash Director. We've heard there's two titles. Alexi Painter. Mr. Painter, will you please come forward? Put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, in statute, I'm the Legislative Fiscal Analyst, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance, but I'm also the Director of the Legislative Finance Division. And since it's our first meeting where I've been in front of you this year, I'm going to take a second to introduce the rest of my staff.
Please.
I think we only have one in the room because most of them are in other meetings today, so we're snowed out in our building across the street. In addition to being the director of the division, I'm also the analyst for the governor's office and the legislature's budget. So if you have questions about those two budgets, I'm the contact. Our deputy director, Rob Carpenter, is the analyst for the Departments of Administration, Commerce, Law. He also published our recent inactive funds report, which is a new requirement in statute, thanks to a bill that was passed last year. Our operating budget coordinator is Morgan Foss. She's also the analyst for the Department of Fish and Game. Our capital budget coordinator is Michael Partlow. He's also the analyst for the Departments of Environmental Conservation, Military and Veterans Affairs, Transportation, and the University. Connor Bell is another analyst who does our revenue and fiscal modeling. He's also the analyst for the Departments of Corrections, Education, and Revenue. And then our fiscal note coordinator, Valerie Rose, is also the analyst for the Departments of Family and Community Services, Health, and Labor and Workforce Development. We also have a new analyst with us this year, Nathan Teal, who is the analyst for the Judiciary, Natural Resources, and Public Safety.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Okay, so in this presentation, I'm going to start off by recapping the current year's budget and providing an update on changes since the legislature adjourned last year. I'm going to cover the fall revenue forecast, the FY26 governor's budget, and then the long-term view. So when the legislature adjourned last year, we had a projected budget surplus of about $66 million in FY24, our supplemental year, and then $7.8 million in FY25, which is obviously cutting it pretty close. The legislature didn't include any sort of provision to fill a deficit in FY25 if revenue fell short of the projections. So that $7.8 million was based on the Department of Revenue's spring revenue forecast last year. And at the time, we had a projected $7.8 million surplus. The capital budget appropriations by the legislature totaled $565.5 million. You may recall that the kind of deal that the bodies had was $550 million. That did not count the mental health capital items, so that was just the items in the capital bill itself. And that was across the two fiscal years. Last session, because we had had a surplus in the supplemental year, a significant amount of the capital budget was put into the supplemental. And so when we're doing comparisons of the capital budget year to year, really I think it's more helpful to look at it legislature by legislature versus fiscal year by fiscal year, because each year you really have, in a legislative year, 2 years to work with. Last year we had a surplus in the previous year, so there was a lot to work with in that supplemental time. The legislature's budget also included about $175 million of outside the formula K-12 funds. That was one of the larger policy choices we made last year, equivalent to $680 in the base student allocation. We also made a few changes in last year's budget aimed at trying to reduce our routine supplemental budget items. We had seen the supplemental budget growing over the last few years, and some of the The aims last year were to try to bring those things into the budget. So the Department of Corrections, there were several increases proposed by the governor to try to true that up towards its supplemental after they had had, I think, $40-plus million of supplementals the year before. Another one I would note is the fire suppression activity. We moved that out of being in the Department of Natural Resources and into a fund. That allows it to carry forward balances from year to year if we put in more than is needed. So if we have a low fire year, you can carry that forward and offset the supplementals. And also, we greatly increased the funding. We didn't quite get to the 10-year average of fire suppression costs, but we came within a few million dollars of it in the legislature's version of the budget. And then the other item that we increased funding for significantly last year was the Disaster Relief Fund, where often we funded that through supplementals. The legislature increased that amount going in to $20.5 million. The aim was to provide enough for projected needs, but then also potentially a $5 million buffer against, you know, new disasters and unexpected things. So the idea at the legislature's funding level was to have a little bit of a safety buffer and, again, avoid routine supplementals. The legislature also funded all statewide operating items to statutory levels. That's not including the PFD, but the items like school debt reimbursement, fund capitalization, and so forth, were all funded to statewide or statutory levels.
Representative Galvin for Mr. Painter.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Through the chair, I think, Mr. Director Painter, you had mentioned previously in a different presentation about some changes that we made at the very end of session that we couldn't afford the time to run through finance and get a fiscal note. And one was even brought to my attention yesterday that I hadn't thought about. And so I wondered if you've now done some analysis on that and have a number to give us that we can consider as well.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I don't have a number of those increments, but there are several increments in the governor's budget this year that are for fiscal notes that were not included last year. And just for those of you, I know there's several new members of the committee, fiscal notes are included in the appropriation bill. They're added by the conference committee at the end. The conference committee closes out typically a few days before the end of the session. So they're using the best information available to them at the time about what will pass. Last year saw an unusual degree of activity of combining bills and getting bills passed that perhaps the bill itself, in some cases, had not even made it through a single finance committee. So some of these fiscal notes had not actually been vetted by a finance committee and the bill was passed before that. So they weren't necessarily on the radar of the conference committee. And one of those bills is, in fact, being legally challenged because of the degree to things that things were combined. That does tend to happen, especially in the second session of a legislature, that there's a lot of bill combinations. Some of them just don't get anticipated by the conference committee. And I could get you a number, I don't have it off the top of my head, of the total amount of increments the governor's asking for that correspond to fiscal notes that were not funded last year.
Follow up, if I may. And if you could also be mindful, I think there may be some things that are not included but that did pass. And so the one that comes to mind, I believe, is related to teachers having masters in education. Or there's something, it's not called a master's in education, it's called something else. But I think that Representative Haddon is my lifeline to tell me exactly what that's called.
National Board Certification.
Thank you. So we do have a law now passed that includes a bonus for that I do not believe is in the governor's budget. And so that would be one I would be, or any other ones that we didn't include but is in, that we know is now in law, if we could have a sense of that to make sure we're up to speed on our numbers, that would be great. Thank you.
On that topic, Director Painter, more often than not, the governor, because I've attended these heads-up meetings, has asked for funds to comply and execute these new laws, right? So it's generally in the budget. These random bills.
Yes, generally, Chair Josephson, the governor has funded them. I don't think he's requested funds for all of them, but we can get you a breakdown of that and bring that back to the committee.
All right. Thank you. Okay, page four, slide four.
Okay, so after the legislature passed the budget, the governor then signed it and exercised his line item veto power. The table here breaks down those vetoes by fiscal year and then the budget type, the operating capital budget. You can see that the governor's operating budget vetoes were almost entirely in FY25. All but 5,000 of his vetoes were in FY25. The capital budget vetoes were spread more across the two fiscal years, with the majority happening in the FY24 supplemental. In total, the governor's vetoes were about $191 million of unrestricted general funds. And I'm going to run down some of the largest operating budget items. I know it's a lot of numbers in a row. The reason I'm going to run down some of these large ones is that you'll see some of them come back as in our future discussions here. So the largest was $20 million for the Community Assistance Fund. That fund has in statute a balance that may not exceed $90 million. And every year, the balance as of June 30th, one-third of that balance is drawn down on July 1st to provide a distribution to communities. So the effect of a veto in FY25 of $20 million is that the fund balance at the end of FY25 will be $70 million, $20 million short. And that means that the amount going to communities will therefore be a third of that balance, or $23.3 million. And that's $6.7 million short of the full $30 million distribution. The way that distribution works is there's a base payment that's the same for all cities or municipalities or boroughs, regardless of population, and that costs about $20 million. The remaining $10 million of a full distribution is a per capita payment. When you have a partial distribution, the per capita payment goes down, and then only if you're below that base amount would the basis be prorated. So the effect of having a distribution of $23.3 million is that the per capita amount will be about a third of what it would be with a full distribution. So that effect will be felt evenly across population, or you could think of it as a larger dollar amount effect on larger population areas, but you know, a dollar per or same dollar amount per person across the state. Another significant veto was $11.9 million to school districts two or three school districts that we funded with this one, to satisfy a federal maintenance of equity requirement that dates back to FY22. This was part of a disagreement with the federal government about a condition that was attached to some COVID relief funds for school districts. The $11.9 million was the amount that the federal government said we owed to those districts based on that inequity. And the governor vetoed that, and then subsequently in December, the federal government backpedaled and decided that actually our outside the formula funding did satisfy that maintenance of equity requirement, and so they said Alaska's now in compliance, which is contrary to the guidance that the legislature was given during session, but that is now no longer a problem we have to worry about.
And why do I remember the number 17 million?
Chair Josephson, that was the amount across both FY22 and 23. Okay. So the legislature last year chose to only appropriate the amount for FY22 and leave that 23 amount unresolved at the time. We had, based on the timing of it, the 22 amount was what we were going to be potentially penalized for, and so the intent was just to at least partially deal with the problem.
Okay.
There was an $11.1 million veto to the broadband assistance grants. That was actually a fiscal note to a bill that was passed midway through session to reauthorize that program and expand it. I think one thing that's significant is we had already in the conference committee significantly reduced the appropriation below the fiscal note, then the governor reduced it more. The reason that was able to happen was in part that some districts were a little late to apply because the bill didn't get expanded until a little later than the deadline. The other reason is that broadband is no longer the cheap option, even with subsidies in many districts. Starlink and similar services for some districts are actually cheaper than subsidized broadband. So there's several districts that have opted out of the program and opted out of the E-rate and instead decided to go with Starlink, and that's reduced our costs for this program. There's $10 million to the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. That was a base budget item. $10 million for Alaska Marine Highway backstop in case federal funds were insufficient. It turned out that based on the grant that we had put in $20 million for that, based on the actual amount we got from the federal government, the $10 million once was sufficient, so this veto didn't really have any impact on operations. The governor vetoed $7.5 million of our increase to the disaster relief fund, so the total amount going in was $13 million instead of the $20.5 million we had put in. $5.4 million for UAF's Tier 1 research, and then $5.2 million that would have gone out as additional funds to school districts for students in grades kindergarten through third. Capital budget vetoes were about a third of the FY24 UGF supplementals, and then a smaller percentage, 12% of the FY25 projects. Most of the vetoes were legislative district additions, so they were things that the legislature added to their own districts. There were some things that were statewide items added by the legislature. In particular, the structure of the budget meant that the things added by the Senate as additions were more heavily vetoed because those were more likely to be supplementals.
Mr. Painter, for legislators who don't care for vetoes, and I want to make sure you're comfortable answering this, it strikes me that the second item, the $11.9 million for the maintenance of equity, and the AMHS item didn't really prejudice those who wanted those funds, that the programs were made whole, essentially?
Mr. Chairman, the $11.9 million for school districts, while we don't have the maintenance of equity problem with the federal government, the districts certainly would still have liked to receive the funds. So I think that from the district standpoint, they would have preferred to receive the funds regardless of whether we had a federal maintenance of equity. For the Marine Highway, the actual backstop usage would have only been $10 million, so that there was really no practical impact to the veto other than to bring down that amount to the amount needed.
And as to the former example, is it because the maintenance of equity dollars are like any other dollars in the way they spend?
Mr. Chairman, yes. So the school districts, they're just additional funds.
Okay. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Through the chair, I'm wanting to hone in a little bit on the $5.2 million for K-3 students. And I think it was specifically for students who were needing some help in reading. And I think I'm not sure, but it seems to me it was to help deliver the Reads Act. And I just wanted clarification, if you could, for the record on that piece, because I'm guessing that there actually were some impacts from that particular veto.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, so the distribution formula was based on a fixed amount per student and then an additional amount per student that is identified as needing additional reading assistance. So it was kind of a flat amount, but then also additional amounts for the struggling students, as you said. And it was aimed at those grades K through 3 because that's where the reading program is focused. And so the $5.2 million was not actually enough to pay the full projected amount. That was going to be prorated anyway without the veto. But without that, then the school districts didn't get that additional funding.
If I may follow up. So just again, for the record, to be clear, my understanding is initially when that particular Reads Act passed, and it has very clear and lofty and important goals, my understanding is the BSA was increased by $30, and there was some recognition that $30 wasn't necessarily enough to move the dial in the ways that the Act was calling for. And so this additional 5.2 was to help kind of fill that hole, and at the end of the day, they ended up with no extra help. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I think the governor's veto message cited the outside the formula funds that were broader as a reason this was not needed, but this would have been more targeted.
Targeted. Okay. Thank you very much.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Through the chair to Director Painter. Always good to see you, Director. Thank you for being back in the chair. I am just really curious. I heard you say this regarding the broadband money. Did you mean to tell me that a program that receives a 90% federal subsidy and an incredibly generous state subsidy is still more unaffordable to certain school districts, that they dropped the program in favor of something that they actually had to pay for themselves? Through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Sapp, that is what the Department of Education has reported to us, yes.
Fascinating. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. And so I just wanted to refresh, and for the record and for representative across the table that didn't maybe remember the size of the outside funding that we put in last year of $175 million. And as I recall, the idea there was, okay, there won't be any vetoes whatsoever of the $175 million. Allow that to go to the school districts. And the $5.2 million was a minimal amount, and we did, of course, meet the $30 outside the BSA formula and added a $680 to the BSA. So the funding was there in the outside the formula funding. Thanks.
Sounds like a little floor debate almost, but it's helpful to hear the sides. All right, I think we're on to slide five.
Thank you. So after the vetoes, the $7.8 million surplus in FY25 turned into $146.9 million based on the spring forecast, so a little bit more breathing room. However, the fall revenue forecast that we subsequently got turned that surplus into a deficit. So now we're facing an estimated $81.5 million deficit before considering any supplemental items in fiscal year 25. And because we did not have a source of funds to fill the deficit, we used to use the statutory budget reserve, but that no longer has a balance. And so we did not have a three-quarters vote to access the constitutional budget reserve. And so in FY25, we have currently an unfilled deficit of $81.5 million plus supplementals. And that likely needs to be addressed this session unless oil prices happen to rise significantly.
Okay. Remind me, Mr. Painter, when we're running surpluses, if they are not sent, for example, to the SBR or appropriated multi-year, they're sweepable more often than not, right?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Generally, if we run a surplus, the remaining amount gets swept into the constitutional budget reserve at the end of the year.
It's just a philosophical question that given the lack of revenue, one might argue the state has, to leave ourselves vulnerable to needing a CBR draw, regardless of who's in the majority. If you just leave surplus funds in the Treasury as general fund, the chance of appropriating them to some beneficial need starts to diminish. Am I right about that? Once we go home, in other words.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, yes, leaving them in the CBR, obviously, then it's hard to get them back out. A couple of years ago, the legislature had put in a provision saying any additional surplus will be appropriated to the statutory budget reserve that has a majority vote. The governor vetoed that. Last year, we did not include a similar provision, I think, on the expectation it would probably get vetoed for the same reason.
Okay. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Director Painter, the $81.5 million deficit that's now predicted, does that incorporate the supplementals that have been requested for FY25? And I believe we have today 14 for additional supplementals to be submitted, and that will only expand that $81.5 million deficit. Am I correct?
Through the Chair, Representative Hannon, that does not include any supplementals. That's based on just the budget the legislature passed last year as enacted.
Follow-up.
Have you done the exercise of the current requested supplementals, what that equation is? The 81.5 plus the requested supplementals would give us a deficit of?
Through the Chair, Representative Hannon, we'll have a fiscal summary in a few slides.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Slide six.
So slide six, a little bit more about the fall revenue forecast. So the December revenue forecast that Department of Revenue prepared shows lower oil prices and production in both fiscal year 25 and 26. So the top right table, you can see that in FY 25, revenue is projected to be $220 million lower than the previous forecast. In FY 26, revenue is projected to be $230 million lower. And that's due primarily to the difference in oil price. In FY 25, about a $4 difference. In FY 26, again, about a $4 difference compared to the previous forecast. Production is also slightly down, about 10,000 barrels a day in FY 25 and 12,000 barrels a day in FY 26. That also has an impact in total revenue. The other change that has an impact in total revenue is lease expenditures. So in our production tax, it's a net profits tax, so companies that are showing a profit can deduct lease expenditures down to the minimum tax. And so as those go up, we will get less production tax revenue. And the fall revenue forecast has a significant increase in lease expenditures in both FY 25 and 26. A lot of that's on the capital side with some of the investments that we're seeing on the North Slope and new fields, reducing the uncertainty of that as the investment actually happens, and then some of the investments being a little more expensive than originally projected. And some of that is on the operating side, where we're seeing the cost of operating the fields is going up. And the effect of these latter two differences in production and lease expenditures is that at any given price, we are projected to get less revenue than we would have under the spring forecast. And so some people have said, oh, well, you know, the fall forecast was $73.86. You know, prices have been more like $76 for the year. Maybe we'll be okay. That's $2. You know, we'll be closer to the forecast. But if you're looking at the total difference, even if we hit $78 a barrel, we would get something like a projected $90 million less than the spring forecast because of those higher costs and that lower production. So even hitting the same price doesn't get you to the same place because of the differences in the structure based on what was projected in the spring. And so you can't necessarily say, you know, price alone will save us because it shifts from year to year. So at the current forecast, each dollar change in the price of oil makes something like a $35 to $40 million difference in revenue. But the difference between forecasts shifts the goalposts of where that starting point is.
And the one way to look at this is the 34th legislature, which we're in, and probably the 35th and 36th legislatures, will be sort of penalized by working through these lease expenditures. But after about 2030, future legislatures should, if the forecast of production is right and the price is reasonable, benefit. That's the theory. Am I right about that?
Mr. Chairman, yes, broadly. If you look at the Department of Revenue did analysis of the two of the large fields we're expecting to come online, the Pica field and the Willow field, and the two fields have pretty different economics because of the type of company and where the field is. But for both of them, you don't really see positive revenue at first. You don't see positive revenue until oil starts flowing. And then in one of the cases, when all those production tax credits have been paid off, do you see production tax revenue, but you see, you know, some royalties and other things. So really, you don't really see the benefit of that new production until the production happens. And for a field like Willow that's being developed by an existing player on the slope, they can deduct those lease expenditures against their existing production. So in the Department of Revenue's fiscal analysis, the Willow field, it's a negative revenue impact until it comes online. Once it comes online, then it's a significant positive revenue impact. But in the meantime, we have that negative as those are deducted against current expenditures.
Right. So effectively, we're taking, for example, less profit from the Kuparuk field, I think is one way to look at it.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, through the chair. You asked much of what I was going to ask, but I think I'm going to ask for just a little bit more clarification, if I could, Director Painter. Looking at lease expenditures, that line alone, if we were to forecast out beyond, let's say, 27, 28, 29, that I expect, I'm guessing, and that's barring a huge change in operating on the operating side, but that should work more to our advantage. And I think that you alluded to that. I think that that may come sooner than later. How many years would that take?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, so it's different with the two fields because they have two different years that they're supposed to happen. And so with Willow, because it is a current operation, as soon as the oil starts flowing, then we'll be getting production tax revenue from that field. Right. With Pikka, when oil starts flowing, because they don't have current production, they'll have a lot of carried forward credits from these years where they don't have production to deduct them against. So the first few years of operation, they'll pay minimal production tax. They'll just be going through their carry forward annual losses or their carry forward credits. So they would be paying royalties right away, but you don't get those production tax until significantly later for that field because of just the nature of that production tax.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let's go on to slide 7.
Okay, so slide 7 shows the daily oil price back basically two forecasts ago, so November 2022 to last Friday. And so the reason I show this is just to show the volatility. You know, as I said, a dollar change in the price of oil will change our revenue by $35 to $40 million. And so, you know, in a given stretch, if you zoom in here, you can think, well, things are looking radically better here. A couple of weeks ago, you looked at this and, oh, we're hitting $80. We're going to make it. We're not going to have a deficit. And then a couple of days later, we're back at 76. And, you know, that's a difference of, in our revenue forecast of, you know, 100 something million dollars of just the swings that we have on a couple of days basis. It's important to not get too attached to any given forecast because of the volatility of oil and that $35 to $40 million difference that we see on a single dollar. And you can see that this volatility, actually I've done this graph for a few years, this is much more constrained than the version of this graph I had when the COVID pandemic and the day we had negative oil prices was in there. So, you know, the volatility can be pretty extreme and since oil revenue is quite volatile, and just keep that in mind when we're building a budget, that even though $147 million surplus last year seemed pretty safe, we are facing a deficit. So things can swing quite a bit.
Okay. Slide 8.
So going on to a more stable source of revenue, our largest source of UGF revenue is the percent of market value draw from the permanent fund. And the current year, FY25, that draw is based on the average of the market value from FY19 through FY23, that five-year stretch. And then in this upcoming year, FY26, it's based on the five-year average from FY20 through FY24. And so you can see that going from year to year, we're dropping FY19 where there was a balance of something like $66 billion, adding FY24 when there's a balance of $80 billion. That significantly increases the POMV draw. So it goes up by about $140 million from FY26 to FY26 from FY25. And you can see we're going to get that again next year. In FY27, we're going to drop the $65 billion balance from FY20, replace it with something 80, whatever it is, at the end of this year. After that, we're not going to see such increases, and so because we had that big spike in FY21. So right now, that's really helping our revenue picture, that year by year, we're still incorporating that big spike from FY21. We have one more year of that, and then we would expect that the POMV will be more stable and not be increasing so significantly. But that is helping our revenue picture substantially right now to have still working that into the average.
And Mr. Director Painter, this is an obvious moment, but no other state, you know, there's a sense of hard times in some respects in Alaska. We had a positive message from the state, and I appreciate that. But there's challenges as well. But no other state can turn to a $3.7 billion draw that just sort of comes every year like the snowfall, right? I mean, this sets us apart.
Mr. Chairman, yes. Even, you know, North Dakota has its own equivalent fund. It's not nearly as big as the permanent fund.
Okay, slide 9.
So slide 9 is the budget sensitivity chart for the current year. And I think last year when I presented, I focused on this version a lot more because of where we were in the so-called waterfall provision. So in the FY25 budget, there's a provision that says that if revenue is more than $135 million above the spring forecast, then additional revenue can go to an energy relief appropriation. Obviously, we're looking at revenue $220 million under the spring forecast, so we're really unlikely to end up $135 million over. So I'm not really going to focus on that, but it is in the budget just in case things do really rapidly shoot up in the rest of the year. Instead, I'm going to focus on the lower side here, where when we passed the budget, we were expecting to have a surplus. Now we've dipped into this part where we have an unfilled deficit in red because revenue is going down, but we don't have an identified source to fill that. And then if you add supplementals, you'd basically be raising all of these up because the appropriations would go up. And so we'd be more in the red when you add supplementals in.
Okay. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Chair Josephson, to the Chair, Director Painter. So this, you know, as we as a committee think through what would happen if we are $80 million in the hole and we can't manage the CBR to draw from that, I think there may be some other funds that the Department of Revenue is holding. Are you going to go over those funds and... I don't know if they're accessible, but I'm just kind of hoping that to learn more about that for various reasons. But I have a sense that there are other funds, and I'd like to know more about that.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, are you referring to the higher education fund and the power cost equalization? I'm not really going to cover those. Those
today.
Yeah, our endowment funds like that are drawn on. I would say the higher education fund on an unsustainable level already, PCE probably arguably unsustainable because of the waterfall from that. We can draw additional amounts. It's going to show up in the budget in the future. It's not, I mean, it's a way to fill the deficit. The CBRs are CBR and SBR are undesignated reserves where they're not supporting ongoing programs. All of our other significant amount pots of money out there support ongoing programs. So, yes, you can draw those as a potential solution. I'm certainly not going to suggest it, but that's a policy choice you can make if you'd like.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. I will be crossing my fingers regarding the price of oil. Thank you.
Okay. Slide 10.
Slide 10 covers the governor's supplemental budget that we have so far. So when the governor introduced his budget in December, he included a fast-track supplemental bill. There will be another supplemental bill introduced next week. Tuesday is the deadline for supplementals. Not sure if he'll have it read across on Monday or Wednesday. There are two items in the governor's fast-track supplemental bill, and the committee has kind of heard about both of them a little bit, so I won't talk too much about them, but there's $50 million of UGF to the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority as backstop for their AKL LNG contract. And there's $15 million of UGF to the Disaster Relief Fund. You may recall the governor vetoed $7.5 million out of that last year, and now he's asking for $15. There are not enough general funds to pay pending disaster costs. That fund has been borrowing from the deferred maintenance appropriation statewide in order to pay costs at this point. In addition, the governor has another UGF supplemental, $10 million to the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. That is the same amount that he vetoed from the FY25 budget, but this time it is a multi-year, so it stretched over 3 years. The governor's operating budget pays for these with a draw from the Constitutional Budget Reserve, which has deficit-filling language for FY25. Just a technical point here. If the fast-track bill is truly supposed to be a fast-track and passed before the operating budget bill, then that really should be where you would deal with the CBR vote, because the governor cannot sign an unbalanced budget. Our Constitution requires a balanced budget. So if you pass the fast-track that appropriates from the general fund and you don't have a source to pay for that because you don't have general funds, he can't sign it. So just from a technical note, you'd want to move that CBR vote from the operating budget into the fast-track if you were keeping going with what the governor requested. And then again, we'll get more supplementals next week, and I think the Office of Management and Budget will be here to talk about them. There's a few that we know are likely to come forward in the Department of Corrections for fire suppression and for Medicaid, and there are, presumably will be others as well.
I'm going to get to Representative Stapp. FY25, we did have some deficit-filling language, or was that FY24? It was vetoed. I think I'm recalling that.
Mr. Chairman, we had deficit filling language from the statutory budget reserve, but there is no balance left, so it doesn't really do much. Okay. In FY24, we had a surplus, so we didn't have to do that. FY23, we did in the supplemental add deficit filling language from the CBR. That's the last time we have accessed the CBR. It was FY23.
All right. Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justin. Through the chair to Director Painter. So the scenario, you send a supplemental fast track without an available fund source. Doesn't that give the prerogative for the executive to invoke impoundment rather than have to, because he can't sign the bill because there's no available revenue?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, not at that point. Generally, the impoundment, while the legislature is in session, the legislature has the ability to deal with the supplemental. The year's not over. Impoundment comes into play if the legislature left town without dealing with it. So if you all adjourned and left an unfilled deficit, the governor would have no choice but to impound appropriations, which, because of the discussions on the federal level, people may be more familiar with that now than normal. But generally, that's really a power if the legislature just left and didn't help the governor out there.
Okay. This concept of a fast-track supplemental, the state won't run out of money until early June if we take no action, right? So if there were no fast-track supplemental bill and we had one operating budget that spanned patched FY25 and funded FY26, would that work?
Mr. Chairman, yes. I mean, the reason for a fast track would be because he wants to fund the items that the governor has decided are part of his fast track in a more timely fashion than waiting until May, not necessarily because you feel like you need to deal with the deficit right away. It's not a large enough deficit that that's a problem. Even when we've had very large deficits like FY15, in the supplemental that year, we thought we'd had a small deficit to turn into a massive deficit when oil prices crashed. We still were able to deal with it in the regular legislative process. This fast track is really the governor expressing his desire to have that $50 million and $15 million appropriated more quickly than in May.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Director Painter, I'm going to continue on that supplemental and focus on the Disaster Relief Fund, which, from the description, we're paying those disaster funds right now out of deferred maintenance account. I assume that means some projects that were supposed to be worked on using that money have been brought to a halt or not started. Do you know how that is impacting the exercise of that deferred maintenance fund that had a schedule of projects that we know is years long? Hundreds of millions more than we have, but that they still are chunking away at it at very small projects. And so is that all on hold as long as we're continuing to drain that deferred maintenance fund to use for disaster relief funds?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, the Office of Management and Budget has indicated that they're holding $6 million of that appropriation for this purpose. So not the entire amount, but a portion of it, yes, is basically just not going to projects. They didn't allocate it to any other projects. So if we patch the hole in the disaster relief fund, they'll be able to appropriate allocate those to projects later. But it will put $6 million worth of projects on hold at this point.
Thank you.
Okay. Slide 11, if I'm not ahead of you.
Yes. Go.
Or finish up 10.
All right. Mr. Chairman, so now we are starting to build into the fiscal year 26 budget. So we're wrapped up on FY25 for now. And so as we're building to the next year's budget, the starting point is what we call the adjusted base. And so we take the prior year's budget and we remove one-time appropriations and we add some statewide policy decisions that are needed to maintain services at a status quo level. So those are formula changes that are, again, not really policy choices. If there's a different student count than last year in the education formula, it's not a policy choice to change the student count. It's just a reflection of a difference in the world. Or things like the statewide salary adjustments for union contracts that were approved previously. While we do have to approve those each year, we put those in the adjusted base because at the subcommittee level, we can't pick and choose which ones we fund. We can't say we'd like this allocation to get their 3% raise for their supervisors, but not this one. We only have the power to do it up or down. Putting it in adjusted base makes it clear that it's kind of a statewide decision to accept or reject that contract. And it's really kind of a new thing that we've put these formula changes in the adjusted base. I think it's made it more useful to compare policy changes. And so I'll be covering those as we go through. I'm not going to go into all of the detail here about how we do that. But generally, we keep whatever we funded last year. So last year's PFD was 25% of the POMV draw. We would assume the baseline going into next year is 25% of the new POMV draw, for example. Or we fully funded the K-12 formula last year. The base adjusted base is the new projection for full funding, for example. So starting with the one-time items, this is the largest change. So there's the largest one is the K-12 outside the formula funding. This was nearly $175 million. That's removed in the adjusted base because it was designated as a one-time item. That accounts for the vast majority of our one-time items. The other items total about $53 million. Because that was a one-time item, when the governor is working on this next year's budget, that's not included as part of the baseline. That has to be added back. Some of the other one-time items here, these are just some of the largest ones I've called out, include the Marine Highway backstop. After the veto, there was still $10 million, $7.5 million for the child care grant program, $7.3 million for additional pupil transportation money, and then $5 million for tourism marketing. This rate smoothing appropriation is kind of technical. That's actually in the governor's budget this year again, but it doesn't get filled up until management plan. I'm not going to go into all the others, but the vast majority of the impact here is really felt from that that K-12 additional outside the formula funding that was a one-time item.
And am I right that even though the legislature writ large may not be repopulating or refunding these items because needs change, the topic of the day changes, it's important, I think, for legislators to look at slide 12 because if you get fixated on the governor's budget, which is a starting point, you miss the point of our role. There'll be fiscal notes. There's the debate about education. His is sort of a spared down, what's the word I want, slimmed down version of the budget without all these other additions. And it's easy to set these aside and say we just won't do them, but that's harder to do.
Mr. Chairman, yes. I mean, if you're really looking at what do you need to maintain the service level we had a year ago, you kind of need to look at things that we funded as a one-time item. Some of them may be truly one-time needs. Some of them may be ongoing needs that we funded one time with the intention to revisit them. I think that would be like the K-12 formula. I don't think we were saying we only think schools need money for 1 year. I think it's that we chose to revisit the item the next year. So it's important to look at what we did last year as kind of a part of understanding the starting point going into next year.
Okay. Let's go to slide 13.
So slide 13, we get into the formula adjustments. And some of these, I think, are significant. They net out against each other a little bit. But again, when you're trying to figure out where we're going from year to year, it's important to look at these too. So one of the largest changes in the K-12 foundation formula, the UGF amount is going down by a projected $28.7 million. And this is, again, to fund the same base student allocation as we had in FY25. The primary reason for this reduction is a decrease in the student count. There is a significant decrease in the brick-and-mortar students, about 3,800 fewer students. And that's partially offset by more correspondence students, 978, but overall that's fewer students. And if you look at the state's demographic projections by the Department of Labor, we would expect to see this trend continue over the years because there are fewer children age 0 through 5 than there are age 6 through 18. So we can probably expect that unless things change in the state, we would expect future reductions in student count statewide. There's also other changes going on there relating to who is paying. So the required local contribution is going up, and then the projected amount of deductible federal impact aid is going slightly down. Those kind of offset, but those also factor into the amounts. The pupil transportation amount, that reduction is also tied to the student count. The school debt reimbursement amount is projected to go down by $10.2 million of UGF. And that is primarily because that program has had a moratorium on new school debt eligible for the program since 2015. That moratorium is scheduled to sunset on July 1st of this year, and school districts will be able to go out for more debt and have a state obligation on that. But they have not been able to do that for many years, and so that amount year by year is going down. The last item on here, the REAA fund capitalization, is also tied to that. That's the Regional Educational Attendance Area Fund. The amount of that capitalization is tied to the prior year's school debt reimbursement amount. So as the school debt reimbursement amount goes down, so does the amount going into the REAA fund. And so we see them moving down in tandem because of the moratorium on school debt. Other debt service is going down. That's a function of a couple of things. One was a successful refinancing by the Department of Revenue debt management group. And another is just that we have not issued a general obligation bond in over a decade, and so the state's debt obligations continue to decrease year by year generally as some of those prior debt obligations go away. The state contributions to retirement are going up significantly, $36 million. That's based on the valuation, the June 30 valuation. You heard about that yesterday, so I'm not going to talk about that anymore. But I just want to flag that as well as one of the cost drivers this year is that going up by $36 million. We'll also see that on the next slide when we get into the state's role as an employer, that our amount that we pay as an employer is also going up.
Mr. Painter, when I arrived here in 2013, the previous year we'd given $90 million to community assistance, I think. The typical year sort of thereafter for a time was $60 million. Now we're looking at giving about $23 million. So there's much less generosity there. And then we've suspended school bond debt reimbursement, which has the effect of frequently seeing buildings sort of, I guess, get more in a deteriorated position. But that moratorium ends without further action in half a year. If we don't extend the moratorium, what will that do to future budgets? Do you have any sense? Will it add $10 million?
Mr. Chairman, it's a great question because with 10 years of built-up projects, it's hard to tell if districts are going to go and bond for a whole lot, or municipalities are going to go bond for a lot more projects. It is when the sunset ends, the program will be less generous than the old program in that the reimbursement level will only be 40 or 50% depending on the qualifying project. It used to be 60 or 70%. At one point it was 90%, but the previous version before the moratorium was 60 or 70%. So it's going to be a less generous program, so that'll reduce it. It's just very difficult for us to say what will be the level that districts will go out. You know, will there be a whole lot because of the moratorium ending? A lot of districts, also their prior school debt projects have fallen off their books, so the municipalities may have more debt capacity. So that would, again, speak to more coming online. It's just very difficult to get an idea of how much we could be looking at in terms of a future bill.
All right, slide 14, if you're ready.
So keeping on going with these adjusted base items, the next category is the salary and benefits adjustments. And this is based on the bargaining units that have already had their negotiations conclude. In addition, there are 8 executive branch unions plus the University of Alaska. It sounds like they may have a preliminary settlement on that one as of yesterday. But there's these 9 unions out there that we don't have this built into the budget yet because that's still being negotiated. So this is just for the ones that are incorporated so far. The first item is that PERS rate and then a small amount for JERS for the judicial retirement system. That is because of the state as an employer paying the full actuarial rate. So that's spread across all fund sources and increase the state costs when that actuarial rate goes up. There's health insurance. This is mostly the Alaska Care rate, which went up by, I believe, 6.2% this year. So that's a UGF and all funds cost. There's several of these existing bargaining unit agreements. One thing I'll emphasize with these is that these are a year-by-year policy decision to fund. We don't bind ourselves for the entire contract by funding in 1 year. So it is a policy decision to keep going with that. There's also University of Alaska salary and benefits increases and a health insurance increase there. The University of Alaska, a lot of that's tied to past costs that they incurred. They don't have a kind of smoothing mechanism like the state does through the Group Life Health Benefits Fund. And so those past costs, they have to make up out of future appropriations, and that's what they're doing with that $14.2 million of UGF.
Okay. Yes, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Mr. Painter, you said that we are not bound by those contracts for the entirety of their contract, but appropriated annually. How long has it been since the legislature did not fund a contract that was negotiated in good faith by the executive branch?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I'll have to get back to you on that. The lawsuit about that settled our current understanding of the constitutional provisions was in the early 90s, but I don't know if we've actually defunded any since then. But at least we did then. I'm not sure since then, and I'll get back to the committee with that.
Thank you.
So are you saying, Mr. Painter, that, for example, Public Safety Employees Association, that state troopers and small town police officers, essentially, they need $9.3 million more to reach the bargain for agreement? And so the governor's put in $9.3 million in FY26, but it's likely a three-year agreement or something like that. We're surely going to fund that in FY27, aren't we?
Mr. Chairman, that's up to you. The legislature does not have to fund it. It's subject to appropriation. If you chose not to appropriate the funds for that, then they would go back to the bargaining table.
That seems unfair somehow. Representative Staff.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I don't think we're going to have to worry about the co-chair not funding these, but in the event that that happens, color me shocked. Through the chair, I do have a question. on the health insurance for the Alaska Care and the UA Choice Plan, correct me if I'm wrong, but memory serves me that the Alaska Care Plan has more eligible enrollees enrolled in the plan than the UA Choice. Is that correct, through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, yes, I believe that's true.
Yeah, and I think it's substantial. I'll follow up, Mr. Kocher.
Follow up.
So I'm curious, I know how the university later, but you probably don't know off the top of your head, but you might because you're Director Painter. What is the percent increase to the UA Choice Plan? And you said ours was 6.2%, which is very standard. If we know what the percentage increase in the UA Choice Plan is, through the chair, thanks.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, I do not know the percentage increase. I know that some of this is kind of one time because of the nature of those past costs. One thing I'll note is that with Alaska Care, the current 6.2% is that we're subsidizing that through the Group Life Health Fund. That a policy choice made by the rate setters in the Department of Administration is to utilize part of the balance of that fund. The true increase should be something like 10%, but they're choosing to use some of that fund, which is replenished through lapsing appropriations, to offset part of that rate increase. So that's a policy choice that the Department of Administration has made in setting the rate to offset that, but otherwise it would be about 10%.
And a quick follow-up, Mr. Kocher.
Follow-up.
On the lapsing funds for the Group Life Health, is that premature employee terminations? I shouldn't say it that way because that might imply people dying. I mean people leaving their place of employment, not dying. So what is that? Where does that fund source come from? What do you mean by lapsing, through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. So when there are leftover personal services funds at the end of the year, there's several buckets where they go to, those funds go to before they just lapse into the general fund. One of them is the working reserve, which is pays leave cash-ins and things like that. Another is the Group Life Health Fund, where it goes up to the amount needed to maintain a certain fund balance level. And that's essentially because of unfilled positions primarily. When there's unfilled positions beyond the vacancy factor, that lapses in. And that will get refilled by that amount.
Interesting. And one last follow-up, Mr. Kocher.
Follow-up.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair. Through the chair to Director Painter, that's actually very interesting. So basically what the Department of Administration is doing is because we have a relatively significant vacancy rate above the vacancy factor, we're taking the lapsing funds from not filling those positions that fall into the Group Life Health Plan, and we're subsidizing the premiums on the Alaska Care So basically, if we were to go to near full employment, we would actually see a shocked increase in a lot of these costs because we're masking them through vacancies, not filled positions, and subsidizing the premium costs. Do I have that correct through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Sapp, yes. And I'd also add, you know, notice the difference in health insurance here, that line between the UGF and total funds. A portion of the ElastiCare rate is paid for by non-UGF funds. Lapsing funds would all go to the CBR. So, you know, you're not necessarily, they're not dollar for dollar in terms of if you save, you know, $5 million from the health insurance fund that would go to the CBR. Some of that would actually be paid for by other fund sources too.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Slide 15.
Mr. Chairman, this is finally the promised fiscal summary that I mentioned to Representative Hannon a while ago. So on the left side, you see fiscal year 25, and before supplementals, we have an $81.5 million deficit. The governor's supplementals so far are $75 million, getting us to a projected deficit in FY25 of $156.5 million. And that's, again, before any supplementals that the governor proposes next week. In fiscal year 26, the agency operations number the governor has is down $175 million from last year. The primary reason is all those one-time items we talked about. There's $228 million one-time items that get backed out first. The statewide items are up slightly. We'll talk more about those on a subsequent slide. The capital budget is down about 15%, but again, I think that's understating the degree of difference in the capital budget because last year we also had the supplemental, and we'll get into a fuller comparison, but really the difference from session to session is more like 38% decrease. And then the permanent fund dividend, the governor has the statutory amount for $2.5 billion. And then that gets us to a deficit in FY26 of about $1.5 billion. The governor proposes to pay for that out of the Constitutional Budget Reserve. That fund has approximately $3 billion in it today, so that would draw about half of that fund.
Okay. Slide 16. At first, Representative Galvin has a question.
I apologize. It's a question for 18, so I will wait.
No worries.
Sorry.
Okay. Slide 16.
So slide 16 is a one way to visualize the governor's budget. This is often called the swoop graph. It compares the on the left in red, the FY25 management plan, that's the current year's budget, to the governor's proposal in blue. And it sorts the agencies. I think the OMB director presented a very similar version. I think the only difference here is that we also have the PFD on there. And if you look at the big changes, it's the largest is the PFD, the lower amount in education due to not having the outside the formula funding, and then the smaller capital budget are kind of the two big things that stand out in that graph.
Okay.
Other things are probably too small to really read.
Slide 17.
Slide 17 is another way to visualize the governor's budget. This is what's called a Sankey diagram, if you care. This is on the left, you see the UGF revenue sources, and on the right, you see the places our unrestricted general funds go. And so the largest source of UGF revenue is the percent of market value draw, POMV draw from the permanent fund at nearly $3.8 billion. Petroleum revenue is about $1.7 billion. Non-petroleum revenue, that's our excise taxes, corporate income taxes, UGF investment revenue, and so forth, is about $675 million. And the last source for the governor's budget is a deficit draw from the CBR of about $1.5 billion. That gets us to our total UGF available for the governor's budget of $7.7 billion. The largest place that goes is the agency operations, $4.5 billion. And you can see the relative size of statewide items, the capital budget, the PFD, and then fund transfers. Just another way to visualize it, to see the relative size of things. Some people, I'm not a visual person, so it doesn't help me, but some people seem to appreciate visuals.
Okay. 18, slide 18.
Slide 18 goes through the agency operations. And I know Director Sanders covered these items in greater depth, so I'm not really going to talk about these too much. I'll note that the governor's amount is $57 million above the adjusted base. So while it's below last year, he does have policy changes above the adjusted base. One that I don't think she touched on was the $7.5 million UGF to the Department of Corrections to replace lost federal funding due to mandate billings. There's two things going on. One is an ongoing change in the U.S. Marshals used to fund more prisoners than they do now. When they're federal prisoners that have charges from both the state and federal government on them, it used to be the federal government would pay for those prisoners a daily rate. Now they do not. They only pay if they exclusively have federal charges. And so that's reduced our revenue. We also see that there's actually just fewer of those prisoners overall not than there were at their peak. So that's another part of that reduction. It's not just that dispute with the feds. I think the OMB director touched on all the other three, so I'm not going to. And then there's no significant budget reductions reflected in the governor's budget this year.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Through the Chair, Director Painter. The question is around the area that you weren't going to cover, just because there's a slight discrepancy. Actually, it's a few million dollars, I believe. So the $6.6 million for the additional troopers and also standing up one office, I believe that the OMB presentation, which was their slide 8, that particular line item, I believe, was 3.75, and this one is 6.6. So I'm not sure if you're incorporating other items, and if so, what are they?
Director. Through the Chair, Representative Galvin. So this incorporates multiple increments. So this is both that trooper post and as well as the cost of adding troopers in Kotzebue and adding that additional overtime funding. So this is combining several increments. Again, since she does a more in-depth one, I'm just trying to touch the highlights on an agency level.
Okay, so what I just to follow up, if I may.
Sure.
Chair Josephson, through the Chair, Director Painter. So I think what I saw was the 1.215 for the 5 VPSO positions, and adding that to the other pieces, I still only come up with around 4.9, still not 6.6. So I'm if we could just clarify that maybe offline, that would be great. So I'm understanding exactly what that's for. Thank you.
Okay, let's go to slide 19.
So slide 19 covers the statewide items. So the governor's budget has statutory funding for debt service, the REAA fund deposit, the retirement system, and the community assistance fund, and the statutory appropriation in that case, meaning the $30 million. That's the annual appropriation, but as we talked about already, that doesn't get it to the full $90 million. So you'd need to add more to the fund if you want to get it to the full $90 million. The $30 million just, you know, keeps it on going at the same level. The governor has a $13 million UGF deposit to the disaster relief fund that matches the post-veto number for FY25. Over the last 8 years, the average usage of that fund has been $16.8 million. If you cut off the first 2 years when we had fewer disasters, it'd be higher. If you cut off the Anchorage earthquake, it'd be lower. You know, what's a reasonable amount? It's kind of a judgment call. Sometimes the legislature has wanted to leave a potential buffer rather than just, you know, keeping towards the bottom. But we'd say that $16.8 million is sort of the average over the last the years that we've had the current state accounting system. So that's the years that we have an easy average from the department. The other statewide item of note is fire suppression fund. I mentioned that a little bit. The governor has $25.8 million going in. That's $8.6 million lower than the FY25 deposit. So that equals 75% of the enacted deposit last year. I'm still not quite clear the rationale for the 25%, but basically you can think of a fire season. The fire season spanned two fiscal years, and the majority of our costs, or on average about 75% of our costs, are incurred in the first half of the fiscal year, so the July 1st through the end of the fire season. And so putting in 75% of the amount would get us through this calendar year potentially, but not through the spring next year. That would come in a supplemental, presumably, in the view where we do 75% now. So it would be like 75% now, 25% a supplemental. Either way, the amount they're putting in is about half of the average fire year, and the costs have been growing on average by about $5 million a year, so is an average really appropriate? When we don't fund this item fully, the result is supplementals. You know, we will have a supplemental in fiscal year 25 based on the projections that were delivered on the first day of session that indicate we're already slightly overspent of the amount we put in, and that doesn't account for spring setup costs and projected spring costs. So the more you fund in here now, the less you'll have to fund in future supplementals. If you fund closer to that average amount, then we can, in low fire years, carry forward a balance and offset the costs in higher years. Or if we funded a lower amount, it just means more future supplementals. The idea of using the fund is that over time we can start to have a bit more stability from year to year, but also that eventually you'll get federal reimbursements come in. They have a multi-year cross-billing cycle. So, you know, in 3 years or so, we may see, well, we finally reconciled FY25. Guess what? We have a little extra money, and that could offset our costs. That's not really coming into play yet. That's a future benefit of using the fund. But at this point, the big benefit of using the fund is allowing unspent amounts to carry forward to the next year.
Director Painter, yesterday I had cause to look at the DNR budget separate from others, and item after item was in there, I think showing increments, weren't they, for fire suppression-related activity. Is that helpful, or is it – I didn't get into the details, and I arrived late to the meeting, but is that supplemental of this, if that's the word?
Mr. Chairman, so you can think of fire suppression as there's really two parts. There's preparedness, which is the ongoing things that the department does to try to mitigate the cost. And there's activity, which is responding to the actual fires. Generally, spending more money on things like fire breaks, which is one of the things they have in their increments on the preparedness side, will reduce your costs in the long run for activity, because if you have a fire break constructed, you're less likely to need to go into an emergency situation. It's not quite like a immediate thing necessarily, because you don't know where the fire is going to be. But over the long term, I think other states have tried to run, you know, a cost benefit. We generally don't do that here as much with quite the level of analysis from other states. But some other states have done, you know, analysis that shows that you do save more money than you spend. When you spend more on preparedness, you can get additional savings in activity. Since we fund less than the average amount we spend on activity already, we wouldn't be able to, like, reduce our activity budget whenever we spend money on preparedness. But in theory, yes, spending more on preparedness does reduce the need for activity spending in the future.
Okay. Representative Gell.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foss.
You can thank
Josephson and Foster and Trogi. I recollect that we've gone through this exercise because of the idea that we wanted to level out this high number of what we knew would come to us as an extra added budget to deal with the fast track. Well, I guess it wasn't fast tracked, but we definitely looked at the last 10 years. Trying to avoid this high cost of a supplemental as we've had in the past umpty-ump years, and we came out with a 10-year average, and then we attempted to amend to add that in. I don't know if there was appetite on the executive level, but we didn't manage to get there. And I guess I just wanted to ask you, is it purely for the sake of having lower supplementals that we should further consider coming up with the proper amount or guesstimation of what the two-year average would be, or is it beyond that? Is there a reason for us to have these funds available in case there are contracts to be paid or something? Is there another reason aside from better accounting?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I think, you know, one thing I noticed is that the amount in the governor's budget is still nearly twice what we had in the governor's budget last year. So even after these changes, we're still well above. Generally, when I've talked to DNR, they've said that they need enough to get started in the season, and they have more than enough for that. As long as you're funding that, they're not – that they can't – it's hard to declare a disaster before the season's really started, so you kind of need to have enough that you can do the setup costs. Beyond that, the statute for disaster relief basically says that just because we don't have money in the account doesn't mean we won't respond to disasters. So they're still going to use the disaster declaration process on the executive branch level to ensure that these fires are responded to regardless of the funding. So beyond that sort of initial setup need, it really is a matter of both truth in budgeting and reducing the unpredictability to you as appropriators of having supplementals come in later.
Through the chair, follow-up, if I may.
Yep.
I think that makes sense, and I'm glad to hear that we are funding the firefighting at least to half, it sounds like, given this particular proposed budget, half of what is predicted to be the two-year amount needed. I guess my question is, and it sounds like you've said that that's more for truth in budgeting than anything else. Is there any chance that there's some concern that we don't have enough money, enough readily available money for a fast-track need that might get swept into the CBR and then have some other difficulties getting to in order to meet the full need should there be some disastrous fire?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, generally when the executive branch is making their decisions on that, they're really not looking at they assume the legislature will come up with a CBR vote if you need to. There's $3 billion in the CBR. We're not going to see $3 billion of fire costs. So they're going to assume that the legislature will work it out.
Thank you. Makes sense.
All right. Let's go to, I think, slide 20.
Mr. Chairman, the next slide covers the capital budget. And as I said, the $282 million this year is about $14.6 million than last fiscal year, or 38.2% less than what was available in the 2024 session after vetoes. And that $282 million of UGF gets us $2.8 billion of all funds. So the largest use of our UGF, 55% of it, is to match federal funds. That's primarily in the Surface Transportation Program, the Airport Improvement Program, and then the Village Safe Water Program in the Department of Environmental Conservation. Our large federal match appropriations. I think, again, you just went through the capital budget, so I'm not going to go through all of these things. I'll just highlight a few things. One, those Housing Finance Corporation UGF amounts, that basically equals AHFC's dividend. So when AHFC is building their budget, they see what their dividend is and spend that. The governor did have some tweaks, but it's still basically that same level. It's not to say that there isn't more need or whatever in a year. It's mostly just saying that's how much of a dividend and that's how they build their budget. There's $19.5 million for IT projects across five agencies. We're seeing growing amounts of IT projects as a need nowadays. And we're seeing five come across this year, and there's others that could be considered for the budget as well if you want to get into that. But we know of five. There's $17 million for the University of Alaska. Most of those items that the university has in their capital budget here are really operating budget items. They include things like the drone program that we've in the past funded in the operating budget. They include the Tier 1 research, not really a capital budget item, was in the operating budget last year. Most of these are really operating items, but for whatever reason, the governor has put them in the capital budget. Another item of note is the $6.5 million for the airplane in the Department of Public Safety. That was a request last year that the legislature turned down. There's a couple of Alaska Energy Authority projects, one for the Dixon Diversion, which is a hydro project, $6.3 million to keep going down the Renewable Energy Fund list. Last year, we funded an amount that I believe was the top five projects on that priority list, and this funds the next six. There's still another, I think, $15 million or so of unfunded projects, and that's from the 2023 list. That was the last time AEA went out asking for projects. They didn't go out asking for more projects this year because they still had so many unfunded from their last list. And then the last item I'll highlight is $5.6 million for the Department of Fish and Game's Gulf of Alaska Chinook Salmon Research. There's no funding in the governor's budget for school construction or major maintenance, but as I mentioned, there's the school debt reimbursement program coming back online, and then through the REAA fund, there's some rural amounts going as well. I'll answer questions before I go on to my last comments about the capital budget.
Okay. The $154.6 million match, is that somewhat larger than normal because of the Investment Act, the IJA Act?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. That amount has gone up as the amounts for primarily the DOT projects has gone up. The largest increase in IJA funding for DEC was actually funds that we don't have to match. So it's really largely reflecting those increases in DOT appropriations.
Okay. Representative Galvin, then Hannon, then Tomaszewski.
Thank you, through the chair. The last line, no funding for school construction and major maintenance. You did mention that two things. One is that perhaps we'll see some local projects begin. Again, this would be deferred maintenance, correct? Is that what we're discussing here, or both?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, it could be either one through the school debt reduction.
Follow-up? I believe there's a list that gives us how much in all the state needs for those whom have put their projects on the list. And do you know what the total of that is in terms of total amount that is needed in order to meet the deferred maintenance necessary for our schools currently?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I don't remember the exact number. I have it in this book, and I'm not going to flip in front of the committee to look it up, but I can get back to the committee. It's roughly $500 million between the two lists, the major maintenance and school construction list.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Director Painter, have you had the opportunity since the federal executive orders that were issued about federal funds transfers to do any analysis of whether any of this $154.6 million match are for grants, project matches that we now think may not come through? Or is it too new? And since those are sort of I just don't know if you and OMB have had any chance to look at that.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, so the primary things we're matching in the capital budget this year are for the DOT projects and Village Safe Water. Neither of those are likely to be affected by any freeze. The more likely things to be affected would be something we appropriated last year, the broadband program. That's one that I've heard could get pulled back. And then in the operating budget, there's funding for the state's Green Bank through HFC. It's possible that that would be a program that some of those grants could be targeted. And then the renewable energy, not through here, but through some of the things that AEA does with federal funds, some of those things could be, again, items that would be pulled back. But most of those are not necessarily affected by state match because a lot of those are just grants they go out to.
Follow-up?
One follow-up, and I'm in particular interested in the AMHS monies and some grant programs that we have anticipated receiving.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Chair Justin, through the chair, you mentioned the school debt reimbursements are staring us in the face here. Do you have an estimate on what that yearly obligation is going to be?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, it's very hard to say. Just because with the 10 years of backlog, I don't know if they're going to have a huge amount right out of the gate or if they're going to be a little wary that the state may not fund the full amount if they do too much or local taxpayers may not want to foot the bill. It's hard to say. I don't really have a good estimate. For our fiscal modeling, we have a placeholder, but it's based on past usage. And given that the program's had a 10-year pause, I don't know that a 10-year-old placeholder is the best number. So I don't have a very good estimate for you.
And not so much the future projects that are coming online, but just what we have there now, what the districts have now as far as the debt that they're paying every year.
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, yes, there's an established schedule for that, and I can provide the last version of that we've had. Some of them have refinanced them all the way out through FY39, so it goes on for a very long time. But we can provide you with the list from the Department of Education of the full current debt schedule.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to slide 21.
I actually want to make one more comment on the capital budget before we
course.
Do that. So the governor's capital budget here is, you know, if I can be a little candid and giving you fiscal advice, is not enough to necessarily meet the ongoing capital needs of the state if we intend to keep doing the same things we're doing as a state government. And what I mean by that is that we had a construction boom in the state from the late 70s through the mid 80s or so of state facilities. A lot of those are now 40 to 45 years old, I should say. A lot of them are in need of replacement. And so we have a deferred maintenance backlog of something like $2 billion, but I think that actually really understates the true need, because the project I've been using as an example for that a lot is the Fairbanks Pioneer Home, because if you look at the deferred maintenance list, it has a few million dollars of projects. But in reality, if you've been to that facility, it needs a new roof. It's not ADA accessible. It's a Pioneer Home that's not ADA accessible. I'm not sure how that even works. The department estimates that replacing that facility is the cheaper option than renovating and would cost $115 million. That's not in the governor's capital budget. I don't know that when people are building a budget for this year, people have $115 million built in anywhere, but there's 100 residents of that Pioneer Home, and that facility could fall apart and be uninhabitable within the next few years. It's very possible that that will happen, whether we invest in deferred maintenance or not. And as we heard, we're not necessarily investing a lot in deferred maintenance. I think you had that discussion with the OMB director about that level. So if you're not accounting for the fact that we have these very expensive facilities that are going to need replacement, not simply maintenance, in your long-term fiscal planning, then we are going to have a problem at some point. You know, we've talked about in the past that there's sort of, you know, it'd be nice if of our $9 billion in facilities we were spending a couple percent on maintenance, but that doesn't account for replacement of those facilities. The other thing that doesn't account for is our IT systems, because those don't have a value. We can't sell the IRIS system, our accounting system, so it doesn't have a value there. But eventually those systems do have to be replaced. And again, sticking to the same agency, I'm sorry, Department of Family and Community Services, they have a system that's used for the Office of Children's Services. The federal government has sent repeated letters to the department saying it's inadequate and that they need to replace that system. The department estimates that that replacement would cost $52 million and would only be half funded by the federal government. So you as a legislature could either fund that $26 million, or they said they'll come back and phase that over the course of several years, and it'll be a higher total cost because we're not paying the total thing at once, and we'd be running two parallel systems and so forth, because there's maybe not an appetite for a $26 million IT project. But if you want the state government to keep functioning and the federal government to allow our OCS program to keep spending federal funds, at some point you need to replace that 20-plus-year-old system. I think it dates back to 2004 in that case. So I just want to flag for you all as the policymakers here that what we can afford on a year-by-year basis in the governor's view, $282 million is probably not sufficient unless we want to drastically change the way we do things in state government. And you're going to need to address these not just in deferred maintenance but in new construction at some point. And I would encourage you to try to consider how that's going to happen and not just leave it to future legislatures to eventually have to, you know, deal with those residents in the Pioneer Home when the feds say the facility no longer meets standards and they're not allowed to stay there anymore. Again, just really encourage people to get ahead of that and to proactively think about solutions for that and build that into your fiscal planning.
We appreciate it. The federal linkage to OCS is through ICWA primarily?
Mr. Chairman, yes. So they provide a portion of the funding, and you know they've said that in order to keep receiving the funds, we have to maintain certain standards in our system.
Okay. Slide 21.
So slide 21, you know, in the governor's operating budget, the December budget is always a starting point, and the governor's amended budget often comes in with higher amounts. Very rarely have we seen the governor's amended budget come in with lower amounts. And I think it's notable, again, when you're starting to plan out this session, to talk about what's not in there. The largest one of those that's gotten a lot of attention so far is education, where we had $182 million of total funding outside the two formulas, the foundation and pupil transportation formula. The governor has indicated that he plans a $200 million K-12 bill. We haven't seen that bill. It's not built into his budget. So when he's when his budget shows a $1.5 billion deficit, that does not include that K-12 bill. So really, if you think about all the things the governor wants to do this year, it's a $1.7 billion deficit. Another example is Medicaid. The governor's budget does not have an increase in Medicaid funding. On December 15th, the Department of Health sent in a projection that indicated they would need another $19.6 million of UGF. And then also the day after they sent that, they said that they received notice that they would get another federal rate increase on the IHS rates that may push that up even further. So we'll see that in the governor's amended budget. We're plugging in $19.6 million because that's the number we know at this point. Unclear if that'll go up as well. And then, as I mentioned, there's nine unions that are out negotiating. Those bargaining unit agreements are not yet in the budget. If we assume that there's something like a 3% increase, that's what the supervisory union is getting for reference, that would cost just short of $30 million. Last year, a placeholder turned out to be short of the full amount, so I don't know if that's enough or not, but that's the placeholder we have. And I think you need to factor in something for that as you're trying to build the budget, because it's likely those will come forward. Again, when OMB is building their budget, they just put the items in front of what they have now. That's not necessarily you as the policymakers in the legislature. That's not necessarily what you should use as you're trying to build your budget, because you have to account for these things that are not known yet.
Okay. Slide 22.
So where does that leave us? You know, as we've talked about, the governor's budget has a $1.5 billion deficit. The last 2 years, the legislature has responded to the governor's budget by reducing the PFD from the statutory amount to a 75-25 dividend. If you did that this year, that would balance the budget for the governor's budget. You know, mission accomplished, I suppose, except that then there's all those items from the last slide. Once you add those in, at the 75-25 level, you would have a $200 million deficit. And that's just the, you know, $182 million for K-12, not the full $200 million the governor's talking about, or certainly not the amount in House Bill 69. That's, you know, another $100-something million dollars above that. There are other items that we're not accounting for on here. So simply switching the dividend to 75-25 is not going to be enough to balance the budget this year. You're going to have to either find other budget reductions, reduce the dividend further, or explore new revenue options. You can't just do that one thing and it's solved, which has worked kind of the last 2 years.
Okay. Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair to Director Painter. I'm hoping that you can help me kind of get a good grasp of potential additional items on there. So I guess my first question to you is going to be, you know, I long, there was a time in this building for me that the 75-25 was pitched as the gospel, and I told folks it was unaffordable because the legislature can't stop themselves from spending money, and it's relying on oil price. How much would the revenue loss be if the oil price in the spring revenue forecast came out, let's say, 63, which is a $10 drop in current price, through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, so that's for FY26, that's a $7 difference. But so if we want to go to 60, so it's easier math for me, at the, you know, $35 to $40 range, that would be a difference of, you know, $350 to $400 million, roughly. And that $35 to $40 million placeholder is pretty good for about plus or minus $10. So at that range, you could say, yeah, I think it's about $350 to $400 million less revenue.
Fault, Mr. Co-Chair?
Yes, follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair. Through the chair to Director Craner. Okay, so that would be more like, let's just call it a $500 million deficit if the oil price were to drop that low. You know, the other thing I've heard, I hear 99 things people want to spend money on. But I'm a little shocked. I haven't seen any new revenue bills or tax bills come out of the majority or anything like that yet. My assumption is that people are going to want to spend money. The bills that I have seen, I assume it looks like an additional, at least $100 million additional on education for the first year, and there'll probably be another couple hundred million dollars on operating spend items and maybe a capital budget. So through the chair, that looks to me like if you had a drop in price and you were to do those things, it'd be more like a $700 or $8 million deficit. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, yes, if you had those things, you'd get to about there.
In my last follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair?
Yes, follow-up, Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair, through the chair to Director Painter. So have you done any modeling on the 99-1 plan? You know, 99 things people want to spend money on, but the PFD isn't one, through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, I'm assuming that's a facetious question, but we've not modeled that particular 99 to 1 split. I don't think that would actually even cover the costs of running the PFD program, so probably end up with a zero dividend at that level.
Thanks.
Okay. Let's go to slide 23.
So, Mr. Chairman, this is kind of switching gears a little bit and going to the bigger picture. This graph shows our UGF revenue and budgets going back to FY14. That year is selected is because that was sort of when we started running large deficits, was FY14. The bars in the front of this are the budget, and then the area in the background is revenue. The big change I'll note is the purple begins in FY19. That's when we began our POMV draw out of the permanent fund. Since then, we've run relatively balanced budgets each year. I think on average we have something like a $200 million deficit since we've had the POMV draw. We have drawn down the CBR to zero. We have relied on revenue replacement dollars from the federal government, our American Rescue Plan. But the CBR balance has actually grown over this period because we've had those other sources we've relied on a bit. The legislature generally the last few years has sort of been able to figure it out year to year. We're no longer running these large deficits year by year. Since we've had the POMV draw, we've been able to work it out. But we do still have a structural deficit, and that's sort of what the governor's budget illustrates to you, is that if we follow our PFD statute, we do have a structural deficit, and that's even before you, you know, factor in the other things people would like to spend money on. And so as we get into the sort of what the future holds, it holds a deficit, right? If we have a deficit this year, then and you don't do anything to solve it, you're going to have a continued deficit. And that's essentially what the governor's 10-year plan illustrates. The governor's 10-year plan is kind of a status quo. Take the governor's $1.5 billion deficit and run it out, and magically, things don't get better. They get slightly worse. And the reason for that is this long-term revenue outlook. So the Department of Revenue's fall forecast projects that oil will be relatively stable, a slight decrease for the next few years from the $70 level to the upper 60s, and then in the upper 70s beyond that. They actually project oil production will increase over time from the current level, which is a bit under 500,000 barrels a day, to 650,000 barrels a day by the end of the forecast period. But as you can see here, that doesn't necessarily mean that our revenue is going to grow faster than inflation. For the first several years, it's projected that our revenue will grow slower than inflation. It doesn't hit that inflation-adjusted mark until FY34, when that's sort of the higher production year and where the carried forward credits are gone from the PICA project and so forth, and we're getting more revenue. And then we're only hitting this year's revenue level adjusted for inflation. So if you can't make a balance now, you're not going to make a balance in the future. The permanent fund is projected to grow 7.65% a year during this period, so you can see that POMV draw continues to grow, but those oil revenues that you see above are not growing faster than inflation. So essentially, from long-term modeling, really, if you can't make it work this year, it's not going to work in the whole modeling period. Things are not going to change and get better in the projection. Maybe in reality we'll see oil prices spike, but again, the fall forecast does not indicate that's going to happen.
Okay.
Slide 5, another thing to consider in the long-term picture is the earnings reserve account and whether there's enough money in that. So the total return from the permanent fund is projected to be 7.65%, but the statutory net income, which is the realized income each year, is projected to be 6.25%. So that means that there's a growing amount, or projected to be a growing amount, of the permanent fund that is unrealized gains. And that means it's paper gains in your investment value that we can spend through the POMV draw, because that's based on the total market value. But in order for those gains to be spendable, they have to go into the ERA through the realization process. Those paper gains have to turn real. And the projection is that there will be a gap between those going forward. And you know, the simple math here, you know, you don't have to be a mathematician to know that 2.5% inflation and a 5% POMV draw adds up to a lot more than 6.25%. So there's a projection that the ERA balance is going to decline. The graph down here at the bottom compares the year-end realized ERA balance going back to FY22 against the following year's POMV. The reason we do it that way, and the permanent fund often shows it that way, is that that's showing on June 30th how much money do you have available to spend, and then on July 1st, how much does APFC owe to the general fund? If they owe more on July 1st than they have on June 30th, that means they're going to have to be paying as they, you know, earning and paying out as they get it. So that's kind of the danger zone. This graph is assuming statutory inflation proofing, which puts in that 2.5% amount in each year. And based on the static modeling, you know, assuming steady returns each year, by FY31 there would not be enough money to make that that payment the next year. You'd have to be relying on earning more money. Our probabilistic modeling shows that if you keep inflation proofing, there's a 46% chance that over this modeling period you won't have enough of an ERA balance to make the full POMV draw. That's not even just having enough for next year's POMV draw. That's even after you've realized all your earnings, you just don't have enough to make it. So in the straight line modeling, that doesn't happen, but in the probabilistic modeling, there's a 6% chance that'll happen. If you assume that the legislature will be proactive and not inflation-proof every year, you could drop that down. If you say, like when we hit FY31, we wouldn't inflation-proof, that drops the percent of chance that we would have an insufficient balance down to 33%. You have an additional policy lever, though, which is to just not inflation-proof at all or to not inflation-proof more proactively. And in fact, the last 2 years, the legislature has not fully inflation-proofed the permanent fund. 2 years ago, we capped the inflation-proofing transfer at the estimated $1.4 billion rather than the full amount with the true inflation that year. This year, we capped it at $1 billion. And the governor's budget this year actually does not put forward inflation-proofing at all. So that's a major policy decision, probably by dollar amount, one of the largest policy decisions you will make. Do you want to do that $1.4 billion for projected inflation-proofing or not? Or some other amount. And again, the risk, you're balancing two risks. From a strictly financial standpoint, you'd say you should never inflation-proof. Just keep all the money in the ERA, never inflation-proof, because then it's always spendable. On the other hand, you've seen in the past the legislature and governor have sometimes proposed overdrawing the ERA when there's a lot of money there. The idea of inflation-proofing to some level is to protect it from future legislators. Or legislatures, however you want to think about it. So you're balancing those two risks. Which one do you fear more, the financial markets or the legislature? And that's kind of where you'll pick to inflation-proof, I suppose.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. And through the chair, I know I've seen lots of different discussions on this topic and different models that have been shown out there. Assuming that we continue to inflation-proof, what is that POMV draw actually need to be to ensure that we have long-term stability in available funding?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, we have not really experimented with different draw percentages. That is another of the levers you have in terms of the percentage likelihood that you will have be able to fully make the POMV draw. You know, based on the static modeling, you could always make it, but the probabilistic ones, we could do a more of a kind of spread of different POMV draws and what would that do to your likelihood of running out, but we have not done that. We could bring that back to the committee.
Thank you. Okay. All right. Yes. Co-Chair Shruggie.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, I assume the reason that legislative finance hasn't played around with other draw amounts is because I think it's unlikely that the legislature would draw less than we're currently drawing. I mean, that would require a major reduction in spending, and I don't think we've really seen any of those reductions proposed by either my colleagues or the administration. I know one of my friends here talked about a healthy appetite to spend. I don't think that's something that really changes from year to year. So, is that kind of a fair summary as to why we haven't modeled a lower draw rate?
Through the chair, Rep. Shrog, yeah, I mean, essentially, if you lowered the draw rate, you'd have to come up with the money from somewhere because we already have a deficit, so that would further increase the deficit. It may not be a unwise policy decision to do that and come up with other money, but yeah, we haven't modeled that particularly because of that.
Follow up. And then, I'm sorry, you said that the overall account, when you can take the corpus and you take the earnings reserve combined, the growth rate was 7. Remind me?
Through the chair, 7.65%.
7.65, and follow up if I may. And the rate of inflation over the last year, if you take out the rate of inflation from the last year, is the 5% sustainable when you look at the overall account structure?
Through the chair, Representative Shragi, yes, based on their projection of 7.65 and the 2.5% inflation rate, you would have the POMV would grow slightly faster than inflation. So based on that return forecast, your problem is not the total draw. It really is the ERA balance in particular, yeah.
The comment about a thirst to spend, I think, is belied a little bit by the two large checks in the Senate finance room. Those are sort of remarkable in terms of our forbearing that thirst. Those weren't required, obviously.
Mr. Chairman, right, those were the legislature choosing to do $4 billion a couple of times as inflation proofing. Interestingly, we also had another $4 billion inflation proofing amount that was because the inflation rate was so high that the normal statutory inflation proofing was over $4 billion. So you could put that one up there due to high inflation, but they have not printed up a giant check for that one.
Representative Hannon, and then Shragi.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Mr. Painter, have you modeled the recommended restructuring of the permanent fund corpus in the ERA that's been recommended by their board of what that does to our draw and adjustment?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, so if you go to a constitutionalized POMV system, you essentially remove all of that risk. You can't overspend the draw, and you can't have insufficient amounts in the ERA, so you're always going to have enough to make the draw. It just, that risk just goes to zero structurally. So essentially it's not going to change your POMV amount. It just means that you have no risk of never being able to, of not being able to make that payment.
Follow up.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. So Mr. Director Painter, I've heard it described that, and I hadn't thought about it the way you just did it, I've heard it described from the Permanent Fund Corporation trustees that it's, our unrealized gains with the ERA and that restructuring reduces that risk and probably overall reduces the POMV mandate. Am I incorrectly understanding that restructuring?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, so if you restructured to combine the accounts, the distinction between what's realized and not would be only relevant from a cash flow standpoint. So, you know, the POMV draw, they wouldn't have to rely on what's in the ERA. They would just have to come up with the cash each year. From a risk standpoint, yeah, you just never have a risk that they wouldn't be able to do that. It would likely allow them to have a slightly different investment portfolio if they don't have any risk of overdraws, but I don't think it would be a significant amount currently that they'd be able to change their portfolio due to that.
Okay. We have Representative Shragi, and then we're going to have to march through because I've got a hard stop at 3:30.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Josephson. I was actually going to touch on a similar line as Rep. Hannon because we identified the issue with the earnings reserve account potentially being insufficient in future years, meaning we don't have the money for a draw for state services or for the PFD, a huge challenge. And solutions were to stop inflation proofing, reduce spending, come up with new revenues. But I think the third option is that we go to a constitutionalized permanent fund, one account structure, and then that has the benefit of not only ensuring that we have those draws, but it also ensures that we protect that fund from overdraws. I mean, it really does kind of, I mean, find that sweet spot, right?
Through the chair, Representative Shragi, yeah, I mean, it eliminates both of those risks, right? So the risk that remains is if you pick a draw amount that's unsustainable, you could just draw it down. You know, the ERA's balance is kind of a stop on your ability to do that. So the one remaining risk would be if you said, you know, we can have a 10% draw each year and, you know, or we say 5% and investments turn out to not do very well for a long period of time. the ERA is kind of a floor, right? So it allow us to potentially draw more, but you know, again, if you properly structure it so you don't have too high of a draw, that's not as much of a risk.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go to slide 26.
Mr. Chairman, I think, you know, if there's a hard stop, I can get through the last few slides pretty quickly because, as I've said, if you can't balance this year, you're not going to balance in 10 years. The revenue doesn't grow faster than inflation, and we're assuming basically that spending grows with inflation. So the one difference I'll say between our modeling baseline and the OMB 10-year plan is because of all those one-time items and things, we're using last year's management plan as our baseline. So last year's budget growing with inflation, OMB's 10-year plan assumes this year's governor's budget growing with inflation. Either way, you have large deficits, just a matter of how big. Mm-hmm. So with our baseline using last year's budget, you start with something like a $1.8 billion deficit. And I know there's a lot on the slide, and I apologize with the interest of time. I'm not going to get into the details of how these models work, but essentially you can look at this surplus deficit. If you just look at our baseline model, which is statutory funding of statewide items, including the PFD, last year's budget growing with inflation, you have deficits, you know, $1.8 billion to $2.1 billion. And this is assuming no ERA overdraws, so you just have basically a broken model here through this period. You don't have a source to fill your revenue. And so obviously if you have an unbalanced budget, we'd run out of the CBR next year and not be able to make our budgets in future years.
Okay.
This is shown, the next slide, slide 28, shows the same thing, but assuming we use the ERA to try to fill those gaps, that allows us to get a few more years, but we're out of the ERA by FY31 and wouldn't be able to do that going forward. So, you know, get into the deficits are a little larger here because drawing the ERA means your POMV draw goes down. Again, I don't think this is particularly likely. This is just illustrating the size of the hole that you all have to get us out of. So if we compare to the governor's 10-year plan, the governor's big policy change here is using the governor's budget versus last year's management plan. There's one other difference is that reduction of the fire suppression fund. Our baseline shows that you wouldn't do that. In prior years, you may recall that the governor's 10-year plan assumed 1.5% growth rather than inflationary growth. This year, they're including the full inflationary growth, and you know the plan is described as this is the status quo. You know, so this is the size of your gap. So that's a significant difference between the previous 10-year plan, but matches our assumptions. There's some assumption differences. We assume a placeholder for school debt. We assume a placeholder for supplementals. Then there was also an error in the permanent fund forecast that was used in the fall revenue forecast. We're correcting that. Department of Revenue has told us they'll fix that in the spring forecast, so this likely aligns more with the spring forecast. And so the governor's 10-year plan, compared to our model, the governor's 10-year plan has lower spending across all years, and that's, again, because of those one-time items and other items from last year's budget that are not carried forward and some of those assumption differences. So it's, again, I don't need to keep belaboring the point, but it's about a $375 million gap in FY26 and then growing in future years.
Okay. So one is sort of awful and one is more awful. Is that fair?
Right. I mean, they both have large deficits, but one is a lot larger.
Okay.
And so the governor's 10-year plan, this is very similar to the actual governor's 10-year plan here, except we don't assume you draw to the CBR to negative $12 billion. We just assume we have a broken model, but not dissimilar from what the OMB director showed, $1.5 billion deficits that would grow in future years. Here on slide 31, if you go to slide 32, that fills that with the ERA. You know, you make it a few more years, but then we would have a broken model by FY33 where there's no revenue left. So, again, don't suggest you do this particular course of action, but this kind of illustrates the size of the structural deficit.
And I'm remembering that, I guess mostly for folks that are newer here, we have had, for example, in the House, 20 to 20 votes on overdrawing the ERA. So it's not just theoretical. There have been legislatures that have come right up to the edge about whether to do that. Am I right about that?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. In one year, the House Finance version of the budget actually had a second POMV draw as a supplemental. The year after we had failed the vote, the House version of the budget said, well, let's take last year's POMV draw that we would have had if we had passed the bill. So it's not just theoretical. Yeah, as you're saying, it's made it very close to making out of one body before.
Okay. This has been very helpful. We're lucky to have you, Mr. Painter, and your staff. With that, we will adjourn the meeting at 3:29. We're going to meet tomorrow, and the subject will be the Treasury Division presenting on state savings accounts, budget reserves, and investment funds. With that, we'll be adjourned.